Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge you who may care about or care for or have become someone with a disability. Disrespect welcomes Professor David Foote. Your background is as an economist, but you've carved a niche for yourself in demography. How do you like to be billed?
Well, good question. I'm really an economist interested in the economic and policy implications of changing demographics. I sort of take the product of the demographer and then draw out the economic implications.
Welcome, David.
Pleasure to be with you.
There are some interesting issues here. I could call this the you can run but you can't hide interview, speaking of the future for politicians and demographics, which seems to show an aging and an increasingly disabled voter base. This poses some intriguing scenarios, I think, in your view. Is that right?
Well, certainly it is definitely true that disability increases with age. We certainly know that disability comes in many, many shapes and forms, and even difficulty in hearing and difficulty in eyesight. These sorts of things certainly increase with age. So with an aging population, disability issues are going to get more and more front and center on everyone's agenda, I think, not just the politicians.
Do we have a time benchmark for the slope with which these issues emerge?
Oh, we're almost there. The baby boom generation born in Canada between 1947 and 1966 are currently aged 40 to 59. So they're in their 40s and 50s. And for most of these things that eyesight starts to fail in your 50s. And so that's what's led to a huge growth in the eyeglass industry and the seamless bifocals and all the rest of it. Hearing's probably a little later. It's gradual, but the need for hearing aids probably doesn't pop in until your 60s. At least that's what the data seem to tell me for the average person.
I see.
So we're right on the cusp right now of increasing disability in Canada.
Okay. Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind probably for most people is drivers. You know, we have drivers who, in the minds of younger, able drivers, despite their low accident rate and the beneficial insurance breaks they receive, can't see, can't hear. This is already changing the auto industry, though, isn't it?
In a little way, yes. Certainly looking for better dashboard visibility. And I often argue that a little bit of lower back pain means that it's probably the reason why the SUV has become so popular. You don't have to bend over as much to get into the and out of the car.
And realize
that's really speculation, not research. But I think it has an element of truth to it.
Did you know that the crossover vehicle market, which puts SUVs on exclusively car platforms and tries to deliver car gas mileage, is expected to be the biggest car market in the coming years?
Well, as long as they combine that crossover market with some luxury, my guess is that will probably turn out to be true.
Okay.
You know, the minivan in your 30s and the SUV in your 40s and something more luxurious in your 50s.
Okay. Well, we'll look for it. It's easy to see the market taking care of a problem like that, especially with the pressure on the car makers these days, losing market share, having built trucks for a long time and finding that the gas mileage is not accepted by today's buyers. What are the areas where the market is less active?
Well, let's just take another example. You talked about drivers, but you didn't talk about pedestrians.
That's true.
You know, for many people, it's just going to take longer to cross the road.
Yeah.
And we're going to need to have a little more time at the crosswalk crossings. For example.
Does this mean traffic will be slower?
Well, I'm not sure whether the traffic will necessarily be slower, because presumably you drive less the older you get, too.
Oh, okay.
And so there'll be, I won't say fewer cars on the road, because we know we still have a growing population, particularly if we continue to bring immigrants to Canada, which I'm sure we will.
Right.
So it's a little hard to say you'll have less traffic, but your peak driving ages are in your 40s when you're driving one kid to the hockey arena and the other kid to the skating arena. It's before they've got their driving license. And
right.
You actually drive less in your 50s and 60s in terms of total miles.
Okay.
So there may be a little bit less traffic on the road relative to the population. So whether or not the traffic actually goes slower or not, I don't know. But we certainly need to accommodate pedestrians.
Yeah. I suppose injury rates, I mean, they're going to require more complex and costly intervention if they're, heaven forbid, if they're hit by a car or if they're involved in an auto accident. And this has got to emerge as a concern.
The older you are, the less quickly your body heals. Anyone knows that with a sports injury. Somebody who gets injured downhill skiing in their 20s is back on the slopes very quickly, whereas the same person sustaining the same injury in their 50s will probably require longer.
Yeah.
So we do know that the regeneration of the body takes longer the older we get, and in that sense you're dead right. An automobile accident, whether it's a driver or a pedestrian, will require more intervention and certainly more time for healing in an aging population.
So we can see safety being a bigger concern when drivers buy the cars.
Yes, and we can see, we hope, the automobile industry spending a little bit more time thinking about it. We also need to think about signs, the ability to read signs from a distance.
Right.
I don't know whether you notice on the road that the older the driver, the earlier they slow down toward as they come to an exit or to a major sign, because it takes them longer to see the sign and to actually read it.
Oh. So I always wondered why that was.
Yeah, so we need to think a little bit about, road-friendly signs for people in their 60s and 70s. We don't have them at the moment, and I think many people in their 60s and 70s who are currently there will tell you that. But with this massive baby boom generation heading into their 60s and 70s over the next 20 years, we'll probably see some improvement in signage as well.
Okay. Now, the baby boom have pretty much always had their way just because of the numbers.
Yeah, they're not any different than anyone else. Just what makes them different is simply their numbers.
Yeah.
Of course, life expectancy has gone up for every generation.
Yeah.
And so every generation lives a little longer than its parents. But other than that, the boomers are no different than their parents were.
But if they can't rely on the market, for instance, to produce a more pedestrian-friendly automobile design, which has been hinted at by some car makers, but not embraced in a large way that I can see, and certainly not touted as a buying feature. And if they can't count on the market to attack healthcare costs, that's assuming that healthcare isn't significantly privatized, it seems like the ball ends up increasingly in the politicians' court.
I think that was a very good logical explanation.
Okay. But who has embraced this politically?
Well,
I mean, in a larger sense, too. I mean, we've picked this one issue, this automotive issue, but, I mean, this applies to every facet of life.
Of course. It's relevant in the private sector, too. Senior decision makers now have very, very short-term horizons.
Mm-hmm.
Our politicians think from one election to the next. Well, that's a maximum of three years maybe after they've got established, and probably only really 2 years to get anything done. So they're not looking at longer-term trends. They're looking at short-term trends.
Right.
Unless you think that's bad enough, the private sector, we now pay our CEOs annual bonuses, and many companies in the private sector look 1 year at a time.
Right.
A lot of these sort of longer-run trends go by senior decision-makers, whether they're in the public or private sectors, because we don't reward them for thinking long-term.
I see. So that might be one of the changes that we would hope for, and we'll have to demand some mechanism be put in place for it to be realized.
Well, we used to have that mechanism. It was called a professional civil service.
Yeah.
So that civil service isn't professional anymore, but essentially what's happened with the civil service, each new political party comes in and turns over the civil servants. So they've become politicized now. The old idea of the British civil service, where only the senior civil servant, the deputy minister, would change with the change of a party in power.
Yeah.
We now have, and the rest of the civil service would give that stability, that long-term perspective,
right,
as they move policies up to their ministers for consideration.
Yeah.
Size of the civil service, we've taken, and all parties have done it in Canada, by the way. No one party has a priority in this regard. But as we've politicized the civil service, we've taken away some of that longer-term thinking that normally would have occurred in government back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I think we ought to really go back very carefully and think about the politicization of the civil service, because we've lost some of that longer-term professional thinking that used to be very much part of what came along with the policies.
You're listening to Disrespect on RadioForAll.net while we take a short break from our interview. You've been listening to economist and demographer David Foote from the University of Toronto explain to us the politics of demographics and its application to issues of disability.
I can still see an increasingly dissatisfied electorate. If the short term is the goal and the answers are in the long term, the electorate is going to perceive that the answers, in fact, probably already begins to perceive that the answers are not being found, and will punish politicians for it. I mean, quote, punish, unquote, politicians for it at the polls.
Well, yes, providing there's an alternative. But if all the politicians are exactly the same, you don't have an alternative to turn to. We've seen that in the green and environment debate. The people are very frustrated, the people who are really concerned about the environment, because nobody will embrace the longer-run goal in any real sense. So, yes, you're in theoretically right, especially since older people are much likely to vote than younger people. Young people vote in the streets.
Right.
Whereas we get older, we increasingly turn to the ballot box. So an aging population will keep the politicians in line much more than a younger population will, except that we do need alternatives.
It's interesting. You know who the last person to raise the specter of no alternative was on my show? Was just this week, Gaetan Heroux, a housing and shelter worker and a member of OCAP.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Surprised.
That seems to speak of almost a cross-society linkage of concerns rather than a vocal minority.
Yes, I think that's right.
And it also seems to speak of a political tinderbox. I mean, what the voters seem to be waiting for in this scenario is someone credible to step forward and offer the alternative, and that's it. They're elected.
Well, not necessarily that they'll be elected, because there are still big party machines and huge amounts of money involved.
Right. So inertia.
It's not quite as straightforward as you just suggested. But certainly the ability to make a difference, to get a few key ridings or a few key seats, certainly that possibility exists. And we'll wait and see what the Greens do in the next... in the next year or two, under their new leader.
So this is in the grand old Canadian tradition of voters reluctant to leave established political allies, but established political allies lifting policy after policy from parties trying to gain traction by offering alternatives.
Well, yes, and I wouldn't say that is purely a Canadian trait. I think you see the same thing south of the border, and in fact you see the same thing much throughout the British parliamentary system.
Probably in Britain, south of the border, you'd have to identify the institutions that they're lifting from, because generally they're not other political parties. Is there a role for municipal politicians in expediting a longer-term perspective?
Probably an even bigger role for municipal politicians than some of the others, because things like traffic and road improvements and so on are at the municipal level.
Mm-hmm.
Things like housing requirements and
mm-hmm.
And the approvals for variances on shop buildings and so on are all at the municipal level.
Yeah.
So the municipal politicians are very much front and center, particularly at a practical level when it comes to implementation of some of these issues. For example, do we want sidewalks that have steps, or do we want curbs, or do we want sidewalks that have ramps?
Mm-hmm.
That's a key discussion point for mm-hmm. someone who's got a little bit of arthritis in their legs, for example.
Yeah. Do you hope to see any changes in this direction in your time?
Well, I think so. I think that will happen. I'm really, really, really concerned about the healthcare system. We seem to be spinning wheels in the healthcare system when it's very, very clear what best practices point to. And Canadians, particularly the boomers, are getting increasingly frustrated, not because they so much are needing the healthcare system now, but they're looking at it through the eyes of their parents. You've got the 55-year-old dealing with her 80-year-old father.
Oh,
and seeing
yeah.
how problematic the healthcare is in dealing with their parents. So there's a lot of angst and anger out there amongst the boomer generation at the moment. And, of course, the snap and quick decision is, well, if only we could go to a private healthcare system and I could buy it for my father, I would.
Yeah.
But we know that usually those snap decisions are really, I won't say wrong decisions, but... are not necessarily the best decisions. We know that private health care is a lot more costly than public health care for the individual and for society as a whole. But nonetheless, I do have some real, real concerns about our lack of action and our lack of ability to move forward in the healthcare sector when we know what best practices are.
Oh, I see.
Simple things like cataract operations as you get into your 70s. And it's very cool to get a cataract operation because operations are done in hospitals and they need those operating rooms for cardiac surgeons. And we need standalone cataract clinics for the province that are run by people who do cataract surgery and let them do it 24/7.
And does that speak for a certain degree of privatization in the opening of dedicated clinics?
No, not at all. They can be totally publicly funded.
Okay.
And you just have all the hospitals outsource their cataract operations to a cataract clinic because we know that the more you do of an operation, the better the outcomes.
So specialty clinics. Hmm? Specialty clinics you're looking to is one of the answers.
That's right.
Okay.
Whether it's hip replacement, whether it's cataract operations, or whatever it is, we know those are best practices in the healthcare system. A hospital trying to be everything for everyone in their community does not necessarily deliver good health care.
So like the decline of the general practitioner, we're maybe looking at the beginning of a decline in a general treatment hospital.
Well, you asked me what my concerns were.
Yeah.
My concerns are that we're not doing this, right?
If anything,
we're concentrating power in the hospitals, and that's... I would be happy if that trend happened, but I don't see it happening.
Is there anything else that you would like to say to address this peak into... disabilities and chronic illness as the population ages and perhaps changes called for in the future?
Well, only that I find when I do my research, this massive boomer generation dominates all the results. So inevitably, the discussion comes back to the boomers. But I'm very careful in all of my research to look across all ages in the age spectrum. And, of course, we know there are disability in the younger ages. And those are really, if anything, deserve our attention more because these people still have their lives ahead to live. So when we talk about the aging population and concentrate on more and more people in their 60s and 70s, and that is going to be a feature of our public policy and our orientation in the years ahead, let's not forget the younger people that also need our attention. I'm just hopeful that as the boomers get to their 60s and 70s and drive these issues more forefront and center, that the general policies that will be put in place will benefit everyone with a disability, regardless of age.
Yeah, visible or invisible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I appreciate that point of view. You know, it's been a very interesting peek at forces at work for the future.
It's been my pleasure, Jeff.
All right. Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to economist and demographer David Foote from the University of Toronto, explained to us the politics of demographics and its application to issues of disability. At the break, you heard Albert Ammons and the Boogie Woogie Stomp. Coming up, Pete Johnson, Climbin' and a Screamin' from Boogie Woogie, the Original Masters. Thank you. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.